Today is our last section of this course. We've been looking at how these different approaches to studying the Bible are put into practice. We saw the example in Isaiah, and I mean, we've been seeing all of this, but now we're going to see how all of this is put into practice in the Gospels, specifically with Jesus. And this is where, in my opinion, this is where things really become, well, I'll just say serious. So, what we're going to look at today, the subject is the historical Jesus. And what we're not worried about are issues related to textual criticism. Okay, textual criticism, remember, is when scholars compare the ancient manuscripts, ancient existing manuscripts, and they see that one has slightly different wording than the other, and they have to decide which ancient manuscript is the most reliable. That's not really a problem. Because there's so many, and we talked about this long ago in apologetics, there's so many ancient manuscripts. And scholars are able to go through, and yes, they see slight variations. A word is missing, a word is changed. But because there's so many ancient manuscripts, scholars can sort through it, and it's not a problem. We can be confident that what we have, well, not this translation, but the Greek text that you use is virtually identical to what was first published when these four Gospels were written. There's no manuscript evidence of significant changes. So text criticism is not a problem. We know that the Greek text we have is virtually identical to what was originally published. As well, another thing that we're just going to take off the table and say is not an issue is the date of writing. When were the Gospels written? Is no longer a big issue. 100 years ago or 75 years ago, it was still an issue when they would say that the Gospels were written, scholars said, in the late second century, more than 100 years after the time of Jesus. They are late legends. They're not, therefore, reliable because they're 100 years after his time. That is what they were, what scholars were saying 100 years ago. Today, scholars have a very different, they've really changed that opinion. I'll give you an example of one of the most radical liberal, like left-wing New Testament scholar by the name of Robert Funk. And he dates the Gospel of Mark to around the year 70. He dates Matthew, Luke, and John to the 80s and 90s, somewhere there. But even that is only, as you can see, it's only about 40 years after the death of Jesus that you have the writing of the first gospel. And for some of you, 40 years sounds like a very long time. And honestly, I don't remember very much of what happened 40 years ago because I was small. But 40 years is still easily within the lifespan of eyewitnesses. It's very easy to have reliable eyewitness testimony of something that happened 40 years ago. Just ask your parents. They'll tell you. So, and even in the 80s and 90s, you're still within the lifespan of eyewitnesses. I mean, 60 years after the events, you still have eyewitnesses alive who can tell you what Jesus said, what happened. Which means, even in the opinion of the very liberal scholars, the Gospels were written during the time of eyewitnesses. Which means there is the possibility that what we have in the Gospels is eyewitness testimony. If you remember, when I taught New Testament survey, I gave dates that were a little bit earlier for most of the Gospels. More conservative scholars will typically date Mark to the 50s. Matthew and Luke, the traditional conservative date is in the 60s, based on what the early church itself said. And John, well, John is where we all agree. John probably was written around the year 90. But you can see this isn't really a big difference in terms of the date of the Gospels. So basically what I'm saying is that everybody agrees that the Gospels were written during a time when eyewitnesses are still around, which means that there is the possibility that this is eyewitness testimony. However, the possibility that it is eyewitness testimony does not mean that it is eyewitness testimony. Those are obviously two different things. And that's the question. The real question is, the question we're going to be looking at is the question, what happened during, well, let's just say this time period. What happened after the cross and before the first gospel was written? That's the question we're going to be looking at. Because we know that the Gospel of Mark, what we have, the Greek text of Mark, is virtually identical to what Mark wrote. It's not a question, did the gospel change after it was written? We have so much manuscript evidence, we know there was no substantial change. The question is, what was happening before it was written? In that 25, 30 years between the crucifixion and the writing of the Gospels. Was it a time when the first generation of believers were trying to preserve the teaching of Jesus, preserve what Jesus said? Or was it a time when that first generation of Christians felt that they had the freedom to adapt, to develop, to innovate on what Jesus had said? So basically, this is the question. That 25, 30 year, or maybe 40 years, is it a time of preservation or innovation? Those are the two options. Either the first generation of Christians were trying to preserve exactly what Jesus said, exactly what Jesus did, or they felt they had the freedom to innovate. And what this means is that the real question here is, the Jesus that we read about in the Bible, the Jesus that we read about in the Gospels, is this story, this person that we read about, the same as the historical figure Jesus of Nazareth? Are they the same? Or is this, what we read in the Bible, a very different account compared to the actual man? That's the question we're actually looking at. Take it one more step. What does that mean? What this really means is the question, is our faith based on the real person, Jesus of Nazareth, who lived and died and taught and rose from the dead? Is our faith based on the real teaching of Jesus and person of Jesus? Or is our faith built upon a story that has been changed, that is radically different, perhaps? Is the story we read about Christ, the Christ who is preached in the Gospels, is he the same as the man, Jesus of Nazareth? That's the actual question that we're looking at. So I think you can immediately recognize this is a really important question. This is a huge important question. Okay. Traditional opinion is what? What does the traditional Christian assume? That what we read here is true. That what we read here, that Jesus said this, Jesus did this, that this is an account of the historical Jesus. Of course, the traditional assumption or belief is that the Gospels preserve, and we can even go further, we can say perfectly preserve, the exact words of Jesus, an exact account of what he did and what he taught. And there was a group of scholars in the 1960s in the Scandinavian countries, mostly in Sweden. Gerhardsen was the main scholar behind this in the 1960s. And they've kind of become known as the Scandinavian oral tradition school. You don't really need to know that. They did a very exhaustive study, a very detailed study on how first century and that time period, first century Jewish disciples, how they treated the words of their rabbis. Jesus was not the only rabbi, and he was not the only rabbi to have disciples. Every teacher had his disciples. So Gerhardsen and his friends studied this. How did those early Jewish disciples treat the words of their rabbis? And they found that the culture at that time was, the goal was to perfectly learn, memorize, and preserve the words of your rabbi. That was the goal. And if you go into it in great detail, which they did, they found that Jewish disciples had memorization techniques, memorization tools that they would use to memorize the words of their rabbi. There's evidence of first century disciples taking notes. So when Jesus was teaching, they were not on Facebook or Instagram or on their phone. They were taking notes, many of them, not all of them, but some of them would have been taking notes as Jesus was speaking. But the notes were not primarily in order to write a book. The notes were a tool for memorization. You would make your notes, and then in the evening, you would sit down with your friends and you would use your notes as a tool to try to memorize the words of your rabbi. That was the goal. To memorize the words, exactly what your rabbi wrote. Exactly what he spoke. Because it's a spoken culture, it's an oral culture. The written word is not nearly as important as the spoken word in that culture. The goal is perfect preservation. So in the Mishnah, which is the earliest collections of the Jewish rabbis, in the Mishnah, it says that a good disciple is like a plastered cistern that loses not a drop. This is something that makes a lot of sense in their cultural and geographic context, where it's half semi-desert, and they would have these reservoirs, these cisterns, for keeping water. And if it's properly plastered, it won't leak. So as the Estonian translation, Veikindlalt, Suletud Bok. It's a it doesn't drip, it doesn't leak. Not a drop of what the rabbi has said is lost. Perfect preservation, perfect memorization of the words of the rabbi. That's the goal in that culture. And so then, by this assumption, it would mean that what we see in the Gospels are the exact words, perfectly memorized, exactly what Jesus said. That was the goal of a good first century Jewish disciple. And so I showed you this at the beginning of the course, the Bible I was given, where the words of Jesus are in red to show these are the very words spoken by Jesus, God incarnate. Well, translated, obviously. The question is, does this do justice to the evidence? For example, very often in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke especially, you'll have the same saying, recognizably the same saying, but with slight variations in wording, such as this. Matthew, Mark, Luke. It is very obviously the same saying, but it's very, very different. I mean, the idea is the same. The message is the same, but look at it. They're different. They're not word for word identical. So how do you explain that? And this is just one example. There's lots of examples. And in some, we saw examples earlier on. There are some places where it is word for word identical. But then you have this. So what is this? How do you explain this? Did you get that all through here? Oh, say it again.
Et äkki ta jutustas samal teemal erinevates kohtades niimoodi, et ta kasutas erinevat sõnavara.
Sound logical? That's definitely a possibility. And it's very, very likely that Jesus did that. Going to two different towns and giving the same message in both towns. Because they both need to hear it. That's possible. But is there another possibility? Is it possible that one or two, or maybe even three, maybe all of them, are not intending to quote Jesus exactly, but are paraphrasing? For example, I don't have this on the slide, but I showed this at some point in some class. I have a slide somewhere. The sign on the cross. What were the words of the cross on the cross above Jesus' head? In each gospel, it's different. The general idea is the same, but the exact wording is different in every gospel. And there was only one cross. There was only one sign. And it's very obvious there that each of the gospel authors is simply paraphrasing, summarizing how to word it. Is it possible that that could be happening here? That they are paraphrasing. And maybe one is an exact quote and two are a paraphrase. Now, would that be sin? To paraphrase. Ask God. Okay. I would say that's not sin. That's normal. We paraphrase each other all the time. And remember at the very beginning of the class, I said how we have quotation marks. We have the holy, sacred, appa, system of footnoting, all hail apa. Right? We have a system for doing these things that did not exist at the time of Jesus. They had no such thing as quotation marks. They didn't care about referencing. It wasn't culturally important to them. So we have a problem. And because of things like this, the idea that we can say we have the exact words of Jesus perfectly preserved is a little bit difficult to support or to defend. And the majority, even of conservative scholars, are a little bit careful to say that. They're not going to go quite that far to say we have the exact words. Because how do you explain that? In some cases, it probably is. Jesus told the same parable in two different places. Totally possible. But it's also possible, I think, in my opinion, it's possible that the gospel writers, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, had the freedom to paraphrase to some extent in order to communicate the message. And the message is the same, as you see. But they are slightly different. So, yeah, the traditional, let's say, ultra-conservative position is possible. And you could say each one is an exact quote, but from three different cities or three different times, that's possible. But I don't think we have to say that absolutely is the answer in every case. So, what are other ways we can answer things like this? Well, what we're going to look at now is the opposite extreme. And this is the tradition critical approach. Okay, we talked about tradition criticism some time ago. And this approach that I'm going to introduce now is the dominant theory in what, just for general stereotyping reasons, we can just call the liberal, progressive, left-wing critical approach. And with a tradition critical approach, it basically comes down to the claim that the Gospels contain very little authentic information about Jesus. For example, Rudolf Bultmann wrote, "It is perfectly clear that it was not the historical interest that dominated, but the needs of Christian faith and life. One may designate the final motive by which the Gospels were produced as the cultic, that is, the needs of common worship." Okay, what's Bultmann saying? He's talking about how the Gospels were written. And he's saying they didn't really care about the history, the historical, what did Jesus actually say or do? That's not what mattered to them. What mattered to them was the needs of worship. What do we feel we need to know about Jesus in order to worship? Now, does that sound completely wrong? No. For example, do the Gospels tell us how tall Jesus was? No. Why not? It's not important. Exactly. Not important for what? To praise Jesus, to be a Christian, to worship God, to be saved. We don't need to know how tall he was. Okay, so there is some truth in this, that what was recorded about Jesus was what we need to worship him. There's some truth in this. But Bultmann takes this to an extreme, saying that they had absolutely no interest whatsoever in the history of what actually happened in Jesus's life. And therefore, Bultmann will go on to say, they were perfectly free to just make it up, to invent new ideas, and put their words in the mouth of Jesus, as if Jesus had said it, but Jesus never said those things. So tradition criticism, remember, is the theory where later each community had the freedom to adapt, to add, to subtract, to change, based on what they felt was needed or important. So, if you want to find out what Jesus really said, it's like you have an onion. And Bultmann actually uses this illustration himself. It's like an onion. It's covered in layers. And you have to peel away the layers until you get to the actual core. If you want to do that. Bultmann personally didn't care about doing that, but that's how it works. So this is tradition criticism. Now, just to check if you're awake and remembering, is tradition criticism overall the most recent trend, or is that sort of where things ended today, that tradition criticism in the Bible, this is how we do the study the Bible? No. After tradition criticism came redaction criticism and canonical criticism, and the trends of biblical studies changed to focus on the biblical text as a whole, as it is here. So tradition criticism is old-fashioned in overall, but not in the Gospels. In the Gospels with Jesus, tradition criticism remains the dominant progressive liberal, or it remains a major part of the way, let's say, the progressive liberal scholars look at or study the Gospels. And basically what this is a counter to C.S. Lewis's classic argument. Do you remember in apologetics, I showed you this? C.S. Lewis's classic argument for the existence of God. Jesus said, I am God. Well, if a person says he is God, either he is or he isn't. And if he isn't, if you're not God, then either you are a liar or you are a lunatic. There's no other choice. A person who claims to be God, but is not, is either a liar or a lunatic. So C.S. Lewis said, if he's not a liar and not a lunatic, he must be Lord. He must be who he says he is. What tradition criticism does is to add a fourth option, that there's another option. Legend. Not that Jesus is a legend. Okay, serious historians fully accept that Jesus of Nazareth existed. It's only a few radical, crazy people who haven't done their homework who try to claim that Jesus never existed. There's lots of historical evidence that Jesus existed. So it's not about that Jesus is a legend. What is a legend is that Jesus claimed to be God. Not the person, but the teaching. And that's what Bultmann effectively is saying. That because the early church felt they had the freedom to adapt and develop and innovate, they created these legends about the real historical Jesus. And so there's a huge difference between the man, Jesus of Nazareth, who walked the hills of Galilee and Judea, a huge difference between Jesus of Nazareth and the Christ that we read about in the Bible. They are effectively two different people. This is going back to Bultmann's quote again. This is exactly what Bultmann is saying. They're not interested in the history. The historical Jesus of Nazareth is a different person. Which leads us then to the quest for the historical Jesus. If Jesus did not claim to be God, if he did not do or say the things that we read here, then what did he do? What did he say? Who was he? The quest for the historical Jesus. And this is tradition criticism in the Gospels. It actually developed, or this quest started 100 years before, or more than 100 years before tradition criticism was born as an idea. So it was the first version of what would become known as tradition criticism. And even today, when tradition criticism is considered old-fashioned and no longer the popular trend, it still continues in the Gospels. So this is both the first and the last version of tradition criticism. It's the one that sticks around, unfortunately. And the basic idea behind all of this is that, yes, Jesus existed. No question about that. There was a man who walked around teaching, preaching, and his name was Jesus. He's from a town called Nazareth. Jesus of Nazareth existed. He's not a liar. He's not a lunatic. He is simply a good moral teacher. He's not God. That's the underlying belief. And so the question is then, who was he? And this started way back 1778. The first book was written of and beginning what is now called the Old Quest for the Historical Jesus. And it lasted for about 100 years. It was going strong, and it continued a little bit more than 100 years. Large numbers of books about Jesus were written. Who was he? What did he really do? And what they discovered, their conclusions, was that Jesus was very, very different from what we read here in the Bible. They absolutely denied that Jesus claimed to be God. Okay, that's completely gone. Claims to being divine, that's gone. There's no supernatural. Nothing supernatural happened in the life of Jesus. No miracles. And so when they read the stories of Jesus, the miracle stories, they would say, well, obviously it's a legend, because miracles don't happen, but maybe there's some truth behind it. And in some of these books they wrote, for example, Walking on Water. True or false? Did it happen? Maybe, kind of. Okay, maybe the boat was actually fairly close to shore, and there's a storm. There's a storm. And Jesus kind of waded out into the water a little bit and stood up on a rock. You know, like going here, Pirita, there's the big rocks sticking out of the water. But because there's a storm, Jesus is standing on a rock, But because the waves and it's dark, you can't see very well, they don't see the rock. The disciples are there in the boat. Jesus is standing on the rock, water all around him. And then Jesus steps across to the next rock. And the disciples say, oh, he's walking on water. And Peter says, tell me to come to you if it's really you. And Jesus saw, well, there's a rock right beside the boat. Yeah, Peter, come on, step out of the boat. And Peter steps out of the boat, but he misses the rock. And he falls in the water, and Jesus has to kind of help him out. I'm not making a joke. Some of these books actually proposed that as a serious possibility. So they found a natural explanation. And so Jesus had a little bag of herbs that were good for healing. And so he healed people by giving them medicine. And he had a better understanding of this than other people. And so other people thought it was a miracle. But it was actually natural medical science. So if they could find a rational, natural explanation, they would say, okay, the legend is built upon history. It's just been told as a legend. If they could not find a natural explanation, then they would say, well, no, it never happened. So everything supernatural is either twisted, the supernatural is taken out to create a natural story, or it's denied completely. Now, by this point, we're into the 19th century. What do you know about 19th century European intellectual life? I know you had to read James Sayers' Universe Next Door for apologetics, but that was 2 years ago. Do you remember? I don't think I have this on the slide. What was the major worldview at that time? Deism, a belief that God exists, there is a creator, but God does not intervene. God is not involved in human life or in the universe. He is simply the creator, but God does not directly intervene, which means there is no supernatural, there's no revelation, there's no miracles. God created a world to function according to natural scientific laws, and we can use our reason to understand them, but everything happens in a natural way. This was the time of the Enlightenment. I've talked about that many times, I just don't have it on this slide specifically. Which said human reason is the highest authority. Scientific thinking is the highest authority. There is nothing supernatural. And so they interpreted Jesus according to their worldview. They took away everything supernatural, anything that did not agree with their view of the world. They just called it myth. Or legend, or they just said, that's not real. And so what are they left with? Jesus was a good moral teacher. The Sermon on the Mount. And other passages as well, which show Jesus as a good moral teacher. And that's what they liked. They were happy with that. Okay, let's erase that. Okay, the old quest for the historical Jesus ended in 1906. A very famous medical missionary and scholar, Albert Schweitzer, wrote a book in 1906 where he summarized all this period from 1778 to 1906. He summarized everything they've done in the quest for the historical Jesus. And what did he say? He said, you know what these people have been doing? They have been looking down into the well of history, looking down into a well. And they've seen in the water at the bottom of the well, they see their own face reflected up at them. That's what Schweitzer said. They have looked down into the well of history, and all they've done is found their own reflection, their own face looking back at them. Because the Jesus they found was exactly like them. And Schweitzer said, what's that? How can you say that that is serious truth? You've simply recreated Jesus in your own image. And you try to say it's historical, objective, scholarly results. And that's exactly what it was. The Jesus they found was exactly like them. He did not believe he was God. He did not believe he would die for our sins. He did none of the things that 19th century liberals were uncomfortable with. He did not believe in angels or demons or atonement for sin or miracles or prophecy, none of that. The Jesus they discovered was exactly like them. Nice and comfortable. Be a good person. Live a moral life. Love your neighbor. But no demand to change your life. And Schweitzer said, there's obviously a problem here. Now, by the way, this does not mean Schweitzer was conservative. Schweitzer actually came to the conclusion that, you know, we don't know a lot about the real Jesus. He kind of left it with, there's very little that we actually know about the real Jesus. But the one thing we know was that Jesus expected the end of the world during his lifetime. And Jesus was wrong. So the one thing we definitely know about the teaching of Jesus was wrong, according to Schweitzer. So don't think that Schweitzer, in that sense, represents a conservative traditional opinion. He definitely did not. But he recognized the problem of what was going on. And he was definitely.